Welcome to the Travel Advice Show. Today is September 3rd, 2007, and you can check out all our shows at www.traveladviceshow.com. And our email, so you can ask any travel questions you like from all around the world, at show@traveladviceshow.com. I'm Chris Newton, one of the co-hosts, and my other co-host, Jerry Fuller. How you doing, Jerry?
Fantastic.
Great. Yeah, Jerry, would you like to introduce our guest today?
We have a special guest, Thor. Last year, Thor and I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and so we thought we would have Thor talk about why he chose the route we did when we went, and just talk about the realities of climbing Kilimanjaro for those of you who are interested in doing it, because it's truly one of the major experiences in travel that you can have on Earth. Welcome, Thor. How are you tonight?
Fantastic. How are you? Thanks for having me on, Jay.
Very good. To begin with, let me ask, why did you choose wanting to climb Kilimanjaro? What intrigued you?
Well, I think, of course, growing up as a kid, one of my dreams has always been to go to Africa, which I've been several times now. And Kilimanjaro, of course, is the tallest freestanding mountain in the world and the tallest mountain in Africa. Actually made up of three volcanoes that have come together. And so I think, it's kind of the allure of it as you read books. And, of course, there's the snows of Kilimanjaro, the movies. And it's just, I love to seek out, kind of a cool adventure, something I hear about. And instead of just reading about it or seeing it on TV or whatever, I like to actually go there and experience it. And so I found a brand new book several years ago about climbing Kilimanjaro, and kind of re-piqued my interest, and I decided that for my 50th birthday, I wanted to summit Kilimanjaro. And so that was a goal I made for myself and accomplished it.
Fantastic. Now, I know you did a lot of research on which route to take, because there are several ways that you can go up it. And which route did you select and why?
There's actually probably over a half a dozen routes. I think early in the year last year, four climbers were killed and a few more were injured. That was already by January on one of the routes from falling rock slides mostly. And I think there was a doctor that fell into a crater and actually was hurt pretty badly, ended up in a hospital in Kenya. But that route, I think, was closed after that. And so I looked at all of the other routes there are, and of course I wanted to maximize the whole experience, and I settled on the Rangai route. The probably most popular route is the Marengo route, which goes pretty much up the face of the mountain, and from the south, I believe it is, and kind of from Tanzania, more central. And you spend probably a few days, you don't have much time to acclimate. It's I think they call it the vomit trail. By far the most common trail, and because you only have a few days, a lot of people that come from sea level or low elevations or even higher elevations, depending on the physiology, tend to get mountain sickness, which includes headaches and pressure on your heart and lungs, and maybe some vomiting and things like that from the lack of oxygen. But that's pretty much probably the most popular route. Well, in my research, I discovered the Rangai route, which comes up from just about the border of Tanzania and Kenya. You spend about 5 days, I think, 5 or 6, depending on how you want to do it. And you actually come up the north side of the mountain, and then you cut around on the east side over to the Mwenzi Spires, and then you'll end up at Kibo Hut, which is the last hut at the base of the cinder cone, and then you'll do your assault on the summit from there. And then on the way down, you actually go down the Marengo route and down to the Marengo Gate. So you walk kind of across and around the mountain. You get to see three sides of the mountain that way, and spend a couple extra days acclimating, and it's not as popular a route, so you don't see near as many people. You have more of a chance to see the colobus monkeys and enter through the five different zones that the mountain incurs. from the tropical all the way to Arctic on the top. And so it just seemed like the best deal. The best bang for your buck, if you will.
And yeah, it took us. Go ahead.
All right, I was just going to say, it proved to be everything I thought it would be, and a little more.
I know. Well, we chose taking on the wrong guy, you have your choice of 3 days up or 4 days, and I know we took the four-day route, which turned out to be fabulous, and we recommend that, don't we, for everybody that does it, take 4 days up it, and then we came down 2 days,
yeah.
And that just is perfect.
There was one couple that we actually trucked around to the beginning of the Long Island route with, who actually, I think, took an extra day, maybe 5 days. I think they spent an extra day at the Simba camp to acclimate. And you can do that also if you want. If you want to, you can just spend, you know, 1 day lounging around there to camp. But I think that the way we did it with the floor was adequate, and you know, you kept moving and different things every day. I got to see lots of the monkeys and things.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you start out, you just start out in shorts and T-shirts, and it's really hot. And you're in the jungle, and then you, as you go up, it just gets colder and colder, and you add more and more clothes. But it is amazing. You know, the one thing that I noted, and did you notice it too, that it wasn't really a technical climb. Actually, it's kind of an easy climb, about 95% of it.
Well, I would say that if you're, you know, semi in shape and don't have any, you know, injuries. Of course, we saw people that were kind of mixed on it and on their way down from twisted knees or you know, injuries they had. But if you take care and are in reasonably good shape, I would think that that's the nice thing about this mountain. It's a pretty high mountain, almost 20,000 feet. That you're able to do without technical gear. You won't need tetons or any climbing gear, ropes, or anything else. There's a few dicey sections up along the top. I remember having read the story about the doctor that fell into the crater. My first instinct was, you know, how do you fall into a crater, you know? And then actually, by the time you get up there with the wind and the cold and the ice that covers everything from the during the night, a lot of the wet, moist air from down below, I think, comes up and freezes, and there's an ice coating on everything. And at a few points where the trail is real thin around the crater, I remember thinking, geez, I'm surprised more people don't fall into the crater. A little different perspective reading about it and then actually being there.
Because the trail from Gilman Point to Uhuru, which is the highest point in Africa. Some of it's very, very narrow, isn't it? You can either fall off the right side or fall off the left side because it's not too wide in many places.
Yeah, and there's some fairly narrow there that's kind of slippery, and of course your guide will knows where those points are and will take the caution. So I don't think anyone needs to be worried about it or think that it's really dangerous or anything. It's just like any time you would hike up into the mountains or anywhere else, you'd just use common sense and take your time and make sure your footing's good, and you'd be just fine. It's quite an experience. I think they normally plan for you to arrive at Gilman's Point at sunup, which would be about 6 o'clock in the morning, because we're only a couple hundred miles from the equator, and it's pretty much even on 12 hours sunlight, 12 hours night, every day, no real season. So you get the elevation up there, and then you, of course, have differences in temperature. But normally the weather there is pretty stable year-round, and the sunset and the sunrise have pretty much the same time every day of the year. So I think that's kind of the idea. And then your last 3-hour round trip from Gilman's Point to Uhuru Peak would normally take about 3 hours. And then, of course, if you did get to Gilman's Point at sunup, you'd have some sun on, you know, warming things up, and it'd be a little bit more of a warm hike. Of course, that didn't happen to us. we arrived with Pearl Peak at sun up, which was really nice in its own right to see the sun come up, you know, over Africa, from the highest point in Africa, and to see that fresh early morning sun glinting on the glaciers was really beautiful. And so I couldn't be happier the way things worked out. Mm-hmm.
I know the only bad part about being up there as early as we did is that I couldn't get my camera out of my parka because my zipper had frozen solid ice. And so I never got any pictures from the top. I couldn't believe it. But it was so cold. I'll never forget that. And we went the first part at the end of September and the very first couple of days of October. And just freezing up there.
Yeah. There is a winter up there, and often you'll see pictures. I've noticed in some of the global warming pictures I've seen, they'll show pictures of snow on Kilimanjaro, and then they'll show pictures of no snow. And you can see it's the same spot, but actually that has nothing to do with the glaciers. It snows there in the wintertime. As the rainy season comes, and it's so cold up there, of course, it turns to snow. And down in the summer, it melts off. And so they have a rainy season, you know, and of course, that translates to snow on top of the mountain. And the whole top of the mountain will be covered with snow, aside from any of the glaciers, which are there. But that, the year round, you go up that I noticed on our trip as we hiked around the mountain, and if I paid attention, looked at it. But the mountain actually makes its own weather. You can see the moist air sweeping across the top, and then if it's the cold top, it condenses into clouds, and then the clouds disappear as they blow off the other side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when we're up there, you find out that when the sun's not out, that warm, moist air that comes up there and freezes just coats everything with ice. And another point I think that we should mention here, too, that it was a full moon the night that we actually climbed the cinder cone the last night, because you'll climb at night, about everyone does, and then they'll leave you enough time in the afternoon to get down to a lower elevation after a short rest back at Kibo Hut. So we left about, really between 10:30 and 11:30. The guides will kind of judge after they've seen you hike for 3 or 4 days and guess at how long it would take you to get up to the top and be in the right point at the right time to see the sunrise, get down, take a rest, and then move on down on the Marengo route to about a 12,000-foot elevation, which is quite a bit different than the almost 20,000-foot that's up at the peak. So we were quite fortunate. We had headlamps. We had lithium batteries. We were all set. We changed the batteries the night before we left, and we're all ready to go. But as it turned out, we never turned them on, and we climbed the entire cinder cone all the way till sunup. Just by moonlight, which was,
and it was bright. It was so bright you could see everything. Just not quite like sunlight, but you didn't need lights at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite nice. For other people that had their lights on, you'll see, you know, the trail of headlights up ahead of other groups of people. But probably a security thing for them. We really didn't need it. If it's possible to time your trip around a full moon ascent, I would say, if all the other things being equal, that was really nice, and I would do it that way again.
Yeah. Now, one thing that we lucked out, our entire 6 days, we never had one drop of rain. We had the icy stuff at the top, but we never had any rain. But the day we left to climb, we met some people at breakfast who had come down the night before, the day afternoon before, and it had rained, 3/4 of the time that they did it? Remember the two guys?
Well,
and they just had.
Also, on the very first day after we came to the Rangai village, which was basically a bunch of boards nailed together, extreme poverty, a bunch of people that were working there harvesting lumber off that side of the mountain. But from there we left, and you enter into a rainforest, actually, and the colobus monkeys, which are the long-haired white monkeys with the little black faces and they have white stripes on them, they're white and black. And we spotted three of them right off in the first few hours of our trip, of our hiking, and all of the guide and the reporters and all took that as a good omen and a great sign, and they're all happy that everything would go fine on our trip, and we have good weather, and of course we did. Everything did go great.
And we also made it to the top.
Everyone made it. We had one that we worried about, and a gal from Australia, but she ended up making it to the top.
I think we ought to mention about her experience, don't you? Because from the base to Keebler Hut, because you're going slowly or whatever, the altitude sickness does affect some people. In fact, all the way up, we met people coming down who had never even made it close to the top because of altitude sickness. But
everyone can plan on some degree of altitude sickness.
Right.
There are some drugs that you can take before you leave that are supposed to help oxygenate your blood and several different things. I didn't take anything. I just did it as I came to see what I could do, I guess, and do it naturally. But it definitely will affect you, and even the guides reported that they were sick, the first few times they went up there. At 20,000 feet, there's only about 10% or so oxygen in the atmosphere. And of course, normally the atmosphere, at sea level, would contain 20% oxygen. So you're down about by half.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the two girls from Australia that just happened to be climbing the route at the same time we did, they had their own guide, their own porters, but we started the same day, we're on the same route, and so we ended up kind of thrown in all together, and it really made an interesting night trip. That's always nice when you travel, the people you meet. I'm sure you agree with that. And so one of them didn't seem affected by the elevation much at all, and of course the other one was affected quite a bit. Some of the signs of mountain sickness would be, of course, like I said, the headache. Of course, you can get your heart, the cardiosaccharine, your heart can fill with fluid, and that in extreme cases, your lungs can fill with fluid. You can feel like a clamp on your head. Of course, there's insomnia, so that's the other thing. You don't get too much sleep. Well, I didn't get a lot of sleep the previous three nights before the all-night climb. That doesn't help, but I wouldn't say that. I don't want to scare anyone off thinking that you couldn't do it, because you can. It's just that you are going to be tested physically. It's an underestimated mountain, I would say. A lot of people think that because it's not a technical mountain where you need ropes and ice axes and things like that, that it's like a hike, and you'll hear of other people or other people doing it. But I noticed that independent of age or the shape you're in or whether you're male or female, that everyone seems to have a different physiology that's affected by altitude, and you don't really know until you do it. And you could be just a little bit of a staggering, disoriented feeling, a little bit of a headache, maybe some insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
You could have some, violent heaves or some hallucinations. I know the one gal there from Australia thought there was a barbed wire fence along one side of her the last second half.
I know that she thought she was going to tear her clothes on it.
Yeah, she kept moving to the side and thinking she was going to nag on the fence. Of course, there isn't a fence. I think what cut it off was she saw some hiking poles in front of her from her mate and took them to be fence posts.
Mm-hmm.
And, and you can get some, I personally had some bright light flashes in my mind, and it's like your eyes are open and you're actually seeing lightning or orange lightning or whatever. But everyone will have a little different effect, but again, I don't think everybody off or think that it's something that you can't handle or live with. Everyone affected differently. Some people seemingly, little gals, with, you know, a small body mass seem to have almost no effect by elevation at all.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, you know, I'm about...
And she came from sea level, I mean, directly from Brisbane, Australia.
Yeah,
and had no problem, or a minimal problem. The one thing that I really noted is when we were at the very top from Gilman to Uhuru Peak, is that two things. I had no concept of time passage. And number two, it was almost like I was in a trance. I guess because there wasn't much oxygen, but I just felt like I was just ethereal or something. I was just moving and observing, but I didn't feel like I had much feeling. Did you have the same thing?
I had a similar experience myself. That trip from Gilman Point to Uhuru Peak is about a three-hour round trip, about an hour and a half each way. And my recollection of it, if I didn't know better, I would say that it seemed to me to have taken about 15 to 20 minutes.
I know it. I had no concept of that time going by, and I almost fainted when we found out.
Kind of funny, isn't it? I can remember pretty much the whole... you know, the views and the scenery and the hiking and all of that, but it seems like it was compressed in time, I guess. I don't know.
I know.
But it's a great experience if it was the same as everything else you're doing in life. It, you know, why would you bother doing it? What makes it fun if it everything's so different?
Well, one thing that I thought was really funny, as we were coming down from Gilman Point, I don't know how far it is, probably 1,000 feet maybe, but it's Cree. And it's once you get past maybe, I don't know, 100 feet or something from Gilman Point where it's hard rock, then it's Cree a long ways down the mountain. And you just sort of dig in with your poles and your legs and sort of go down. And but I looked back, and you were sort of skiing. You would go to the left and then turn and go to the right, and you're skiing down basically with your feet and your poles. Do you remember doing that?
You'll walk those Scree paths going up. You'll kind of switch back and forth to get up at the end of the night. But when you come down, you're anxious to come down to a lower elevation quickly anyway. And everyone just cuts right down through the middle. And you can just kind of lean back if you have some hiking poles with you, which I would recommend. You can use my ski poles, and you can go quite a distance just sliding on the Scree.
You were going to the left and you turn and go to the right and you're actually skiing down that mountain. I was going straight down that thing as fast as I could to get down there.
It certainly was fun coming down.
I know it. Oh, tired. I was so tired when I got back to Kibo. I thought I was going to die.
You know, I'll tell you one more thing. We talked about hiking up there by moonlight. I had noticed on the way up that I seemed to have this dust all over my coat. I had a red and black parka on, and it was just a Gore-Tex shell. But it seemed to be covered with dust all the time, and I couldn't brush it off. I was always trying to brush it off. And then later on, I realized that it wasn't dust at all. It was ice.
I know.
I remember seeing your pack from behind. It was just completely covered with ice. My mustache had icicles hanging down off of it.
Yeah, the eyebrows and your hair, everything is ice. Well, as you're going up maybe around 18,000 foot, I remember looking up, and it looked like there was a very thin cloud. And as you went through it, you could still see, but it's a very thin cloud. And as you got through that cloud, that's when everything turned like looked like we had dust on us.
Yeah.
And it turned out it was solid ice. We were just frozen. I called our clothes and eyebrows and...
The first camp that we stayed at was the Simba camp, I believe. And from then on, I mean, even from that one there, we were above the clouds. We could look out over the Kenyan Plains, and the clouds would clear later on in the morning. You could see down onto the plains and everything in Kenya. But every day we were above the clouds. And there were some fantastic cloud formations, especially over at the Mwenzi Spires where we camped there, I think, third night. There's a little tarn there, which is a high altitude pond or lake. It's called a tarn. Same as in Australia or Scotland or New Zealand or in Scotland or wherever. It's the same there. English influence, I guess. And we camped there because of that tarn, because there's water there. But some of the cloud formations that blew over and through and around the spires made some fantastic photographs.
Oh, I know. The photography was excellent. I think we ought to spend just a minute about the food and the bath and the toilets, because I think that's interesting.
As far as the technical side of things, if you're going to do this trip, maybe some people would have some questions, like I know I did, about what should I bring and what will I eat and what are the facilities like. Well, you'll just need some warm clothes, some fleece, and some wool socks. Of course, you just hike it in sneakers, and basically, lots of people will bring heavy leather boots and shoes. I just use trail sneakers. They usually have a more aggressive tread. They're a little tougher than your standard sneaker, but that's pretty much all I ever wear anywhere. Some gaiters are nice. Keep the scree out of your shoes and provide a little bit of the wind resistance. But you'll want some kind of a parka, like a shell, and maybe a fleece jacket underneath that, some long johns. I hiked all the way to Keebo Hut with shorts, and I think I did put my fleece on the last day. I still wore my shorts, though, and a lot of the porters will think you're crazy because they're used to it being hot, and if it's down to 70, they're getting cold,
I know.
So they'll be bundled up in mittens and gloves and everything and think you're crazy if you're hiking in shorts, but
it's
so comfortable here with the sun out.
I know. Most of that trip, we never wore anything except just either short sleeve shirts or long sleeve shirts.
Single nylon shirt, light shirt, shorts, wool sneakers.
That's nice.
Of course, going up, you're going to want a warm hat. I don't think you could have a balaclava if you wanted to, or something around your neck, or scarf or whatever. But
yeah, we almost never wore a hat, did we?
I wore a sleek windstopper hat. The wind is quite severe up there. It can be.
But the top, from Keebo Hut up, you better wear a lot of warm clothes because it's cold.
Just something to shade yourself. The sun can be intense. You'll need sunglasses and the sunscreen.
I was amazed at how temperate.
You're in Africa, and when you stay at the lodge, when you first get there, it's quite nice. Of course, there's brownouts, there's rationed electricity. The food, I thought, was pretty good. And the porters carry everything on the trip, and they set up a little tent to eat in every night. And it's just amazing what you see those guys carrying, and stacks of chairs, a table on their head, whatever. It's unbelievable, the stuff they carry. And I will say this, that when you go to Africa, if you decide to climb Kilimanjaro, or any time you go to Africa, you need to really take some things for the people there, because I always tell people, Africa to me is one of the greatest places. It's like going to another planet. Everything is different. The plants, the animals, the night sky, if you're in the southern countries, the languages, the culture, the food, everything. But, these are people that just don't have a lot. And I spend most of the weight in my luggage taking presents with stuffed animals, matchbox cars. They'll love take some reams of paper. You'll see little kids who will just clutch one sheet of paper and run off happy. Pens and pencils and crayons, almost anything you have. And you can just go to the thrift store and load up on a lot of these things and take them over and give them out, especially the children. There's so many children running around. And when you go there, you'll have the greatest experience of your life, I think. It's, of course, everything's what you make it. But you'll also, what I call ghosts. You'll come home, and I think there's some parts of you that change. There is every time I go to Africa, and some sights and memories that are unique that you'll only have when you go there and experience it. But I think that it makes me a better person, a little more compassionate, I think, and more thankful for what I have. After you leave the lodge and you're on your way up the mountain, things are fairly primitive. Little camps to stay at. There's some outhouses, which are way worse than when I was a young lad at Boy Scout camp.
And you better take a full roll of toilet paper for that trip, because I ended up running out and had to borrow some of yours because my sinuses started going wild with the dust.
You need
and
to
I had to blow my nose all the time.
Yeah, you need to take whatever you need because it's not that, you know, there's, you won't have time to go get it. A lot of the things you might be used to or want that you can't get. So, you know, go ahead and take the things that you need with you and don't plan on getting married anyway. If you take some money, this is one thing I wish I would have done too. You know, you think you want to climb and Kilimanjaro without any money for, and I think I took $10 or something just in ones. And every time you go to Africa, it's a good idea to take several $100 in $1 bills. Because if you want to, well, the currency is, I mean, the people, and you go to southern countries in Africa, in Zimbabwe and places like that, people work for a dollar a day or less. It's a going rate. So you can do the wrong thing for the right reason. Sometimes by giving out too much money, you can stir up trouble and change. But you have to go with the culture that's there, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And you want to take small denominations of older money. Sometimes they don't trust new money. They think it's been created. take some money with you on the Marangu route coming down. You won't see this on the back of the mountain, but on coming down, there's porters who carry Cokes and Kilimanjaro beer up to the huts, and you can actually, you know, buy a beer or Coke or some candy or something at some of those huts on the way down on the Marangu route, since it is so touristy. But it's nice to be able to buy a Coke for the porters, or about $1, $2 a piece or something.
I know.
Carry them up. And in the grand scheme of things, these are guys that probably don't get a beer or a Coke very often. So it's really a nice, appreciative thing to do for them. And I will say also, we took a bunch of clothes and things for the porters. They kind of, a lot of what they have, they rely on being given to them, not because they wouldn't save up and buy it, although their funds are meager. There just isn't any place to go to buy a fleece jacket there. So
I know.
Five jackets and fleece pants, and gave away a lot of our gear to the porters and to the guides at the end of our trip. They wore those five fleece jackets the whole time, and I often wonder, what were they going to wear if we hadn't brought those, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, they do get cold. It is cold up there. So anything you can bring to help them out that way, whether it's, you know, shoes or sneakers or fleece coats, hats, mittens, fleece pants, a nice duffel bag. You know, some people, these porters will carry anything that you bring, but I would say bring a duffel bag, like a PVC coated duffel bag is nice. If it does rain, everything will stay dry inside, and have some straps on there so they can wear it on their back. Otherwise, they will carry it on their head, and they'll carry a suitcase if that's what you bring, but, just you wouldn't want to carry a suitcase on your head, and I'm sure they would rather not either. So think of it that way. And then, you know, try and plan on leaving stuff behind. It's nice because you can go out into Moshi and Arusha or any little towns around, and you can, you know, trade if you want or buy some things, help out the local economy, pick up some really nice things, and you can bring those back, and you'll have a 50-pound weight limit leaving Kilimanjaro Airport. It'll really ding you for extra weight money-wise. So you don't want to carry back all the stuff you can get here anywhere, you know, any day anyway. So give those away as presents or trade or whatever you want to do, and use the space to bring back some of their things and help out their economy and bring some of their crafty things, because they really do have a lot of interesting things and things that will be nice mementos of your trip and things that you couldn't get anywhere else. So I would suggest doing that. And again, take a lot of small denominations. And remember that most everything is checked before you go with wherever you stay or who you book with. But most everything is cash or traveler's checks. But a lot of places you're not going to be able to use credit cards, things like that, because they don't have the facilities for that.
Fortunately, we knew that ahead of time, because if we hadn't taken that extra lot of money, we'd have been really hurting.
Yeah. Yeah, taking extra money. I have a neck pouch I like to wear around my neck. It's tucked inside my shirt. I keep my passport in there. I keep a credit card just because if you're in a town like Arusha or a bigger city like that, you could use a credit card. But then I keep the cash in there also, and it's around my neck all the time, and keep control of it. And then I typically will take small denominations, maybe 10 or 20 $1 bills, have in a shirt pocket. And, you know, if you want to give some tips to someone at the lodge or buy a beer for somebody or something, you don't want to be pulling out a great big old lot of money, you know.
I know. Well, Thor, we're about out of time. I can't believe it.
Yeah, that was great. I really want to go to Kilimanjaro. I've never been in that area before, but I learned so much. So, yeah, thank you, Thor, for giving your insight about your trip.
My pleasure. I hope that anyone listening has any kind of desire at all to go to East Africa and see the animals and climb Kilimanjaro, will just go and do it. You know, whether you make it all the way to the top, it'll be a great experience. You have a high success rate there of making it. Just give them a little bit of shape, a little aerobic exercise, and use your common sense, and you'll have a great time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Thor. It's been a great show, and we'll start again next week.